WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
60% of the world's people live in Asia, 5% in North America. So what happens in Asia inevitably affects the rest of the world. My guests, Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn, covered Asia for The New York Times for 14 years, based in Beijing and Tokyo. They're married and shared a Pulitzer Prize in 1990 for their coverage of Tiananmen Square and the suppression of the Chinese democracy movement. They've collaborated on a new book called Thunder from the East, Portrait of a Rising Asia. Now that they're back in the States, Wu Dunn is working on the business side of the Times. Kristof has been writing a series of biographical pieces about George W. Bush. Part of their new book is about how the Asian economic crisis that began in Thailand in 1997 has changed the lives of people in Asian countries. Kristof and Wu Dunn have an unusual view of the Asian economic crisis. They think that in some ways it was the best thing that could have happened to Asia. I asked why.
Certainly, a lot of people lost money. Foreign investors lost a lot. And so it was a terrible fiasco for some of them. However, the real reason we think that it's the best thing that happened to Asia is because Asia was, yes, it was on a roll, but it was also getting much more arrogant. It was sort of exceeding itself. It was just filled with pride. It was just too proud. It didn't think that anything was worth learning from the West. They wanted the money and they just let us do things our way. But that was wrong. And what the Asian financial crisis taught people was that you need the rule of law. You need discipline. You need to do things a little bit more in an international context. You need to listen to investors, and you're going to have to meet deadlines. You're going to have to meet the clarity of your accounting rules and transparency and the way you do things. And you're going to have to build better banking systems. Now, it's going to take a long time for these countries to get there, but there was a wake-up call and the beginning of recognition that they have to start rebuilding their systems.
Nick, you went to a brothel in Cambodia as part of your reporting from Asia, and you interviewed a 13-year-old prostitute. Why did you go to this brothel in the first place?
I had heard that Cambodia in particular still had slaves, in the sense that 19th century America had slaves. These were kids who were sold, and if they tried to escape the brothels, they were arrested by the police. They were locked up and imprisoned in the brothels. And it turned out to be indeed very easy to find these kids. And there was one girl in particular, Sri, who, as you say, was 13, who left a deep impression on me. She was very charming, very vivacious, very outgoing, and she had been sold by her mother and stepfather 2 years earlier when she was just 11 years old.
Yeah, she seemed pretty enthusiastic about her work as a prostitute in this brothel, and she seemed pretty fearless in terms of sexually transmitted diseases. She was very uninformed and thought that she was too young to get any diseases, but it sounds like her mood really changed when you asked her about how she ended up at the brothel. What story did she tell you about why her parents sold her?
She said that her father had died and her mother had remarried, and that her stepfather didn't like her, beat her, resented her, and then her mother became sick, some kind of a lung disease, it seemed, and the parents agreed, under pressure from the stepfather, to sell her for cash, for money to treat the mother. And there's no way of verifying that, but that was what she said. And she was filled, on the one hand, with, you know, love for her mother. She didn't want to criticize her mother. And on the other hand, she was, obviously, she realized that she'd been trapped in this terrible, terrible situation, and she resented it. And for a 13-year-old girl to pour through all this in her mind was real agony for her.
So you said you found it impossible to imagine how parents can sell a child into slavery. Did you have any experiences that helped you understand that a little better?
Then just a few months later, I was walking through the jungle in Cambodia, and I came across a man named Yuk Yorn, who whose son had just died of malaria that morning. And he was wailing and clutching the body of his son, and we talked for a while. He had seven children. This boy, Kaiset, was the second son to die of malaria. And we were talking about this. He was just terrible. He felt terrible for having betrayed Kaiset, for having allowed Kaiset to die. He was terribly worried that the rest of his children would also get malaria and also die. And this was all, in a sense, for want of about $5 to buy a mosquito net that could protect them. And so I must say that as he was talking about this and worrying about the rest of his kids dying, I could imagine somebody like him selling his daughter, for example, he had a 19-year-old daughter, selling her and getting the money to get mosquito nets to save the rest of the children. And I mean, I felt terrible for even letting that thought flash through my mind, but that clearly is the kind of choice that a lot of people have to make in these places.
And I want to ask you about another thing that you found. You went to a trash dump, a huge, several-mile trash dump that people live near and go in to pick in, to pick for things. Where was the trash dump?
This was in Jakarta, Indonesia, and there were hundreds or probably thousands of people who make a living going through the dump, picking up things that they can sell for recycling. And in particular, there was a mother named Tratiwun and her small son, whom I interviewed. And what struck me about it was that Tratiwun's real aspiration for her son was that he would grow up and be able to work in a sweatshop. And it just seemed so strange to hear somebody talk about that. And I mean, she in a sense doubted that he would be lucky enough or educated enough to get a sweatshop job, which he kind of regarded as a dream job, because he would be off the dump and in a building and have much less exposure to disease and things. But it reflected, I think, different attitudes towards sweatshops among people who were at the very bottom of the third world.
Yeah, because in America, a lot of consumers are trying to punish businesses that set up sweatshops in Asia. You're saying for the people there, it might be better than the other alternatives.
In many ways, actually, we do believe that. I have to admit that when I first got out to Asia, I didn't think that was the case. I remember going through the south of China and seeing these women work in terrible, terrible conditions. One time I was in a textile mill and I was in this room with hundreds of women at machines. Their fingers were flying and I was thinking, my God, my fingers could never work that fast. But the one thing that was striking me was the fact that my ears were hurting because of the beating sound and the machines. It was just rumbling in my ears and it was really hurting my ears. And they had to work in this kind of conditions day in, day out. And the factory managers weren't caring about it. So this, obviously, it's a terrible situation. However, I started talking to the people and I realized these are the alternatives that they have are also very grim. My family, my distant relatives actually, are in Guangdong province. And when I went to visit them, it's a small stone hut off the side of a rice paddy, and some of them, they go out and they trek out into the rice paddies and they take off their shoes so they don't get muddied, and they go out barefoot. They can be exposed to all sorts of diseases. My goodness, I don't even want to think about it, but they're doing back-breaking labor all day out in the sun, and then they come home. But when a shop, a factory opens up nearby, everybody streams to those jobs because they're wonderful compared to what they have to do out in the sun. It's funny, here in the States, we look at them as sweatshops, but out in Asia, a lot of people are curious, why do they call them sweatshops? When you're out in the rice paddies, you sweat. When you're on the construction site, and believe me, the labor laws are much looser out there, you sweat there. When you're a rickshaw driver or you're driving a lorry, you sweat. But you don't sweat inside a factory. An interpreter once told us that, she couldn't understand why the word sweat was used in that manner. And I think it's because for Asians, sweatshops are really the road to prosperity. It's the way that the son or the daughter or even the husband or the wife can earn a steady paycheck and build a skill. I mean, skilled labor is really a new phenomenon there. And that's how the sweatshops, that's how industrialization takes place in a country. I mean, it sounds awful, but in many ways, that's, you know, who are the people who are making the toys in China, who are making the, stitching the shoes, who are, you know, making the leather jackets? It's the women in the sweatshops.
You know, but it, what you're saying kind of gives justification to corporations who move to other countries because they know that they can pay the labor there next to nothing and get away with it.
Yeah, I must say that we thought that the activists in this country were much more well-meaning than a lot of the corporate titans, and we respected the altruism of the activists more, but we also felt that they risked hurting the people that they were trying to help, and that, I mean, what a country like Cambodia needs, in a sense, is more sweatshops and more factories where people can work and get the money for mosquito nets so that the people don't die of malaria. And it, in a sense, almost however grim the sweatshops are, they're going to be better than a lot of the existing alternatives that people have.
My guests are Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudun of the New York Times. Their new book is called Thunder from the East. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudun of the New York Times. They've collaborated on a new book based on their reporting from Asia. It's called Thunder from the East. When we left off, we'd been talking about whether sweatshops were better than the other grim alternatives for poor people in Asia.
It's a very tough issue. And, you know, I have to say that there are times when we don't want to feel as though we're siding with the big corporations because there is some exploitation that takes place there. On the other hand, there is a, you know, somewhat of a market, because when the next joint venture comes into town, if they want to steal skilled workers, they need to pay a little bit more. And so wages are bid up. And so people start demanding better conditions when there's, you know, when the next joint venture comes into town, the workers will only leave their current job if there's either better pay or better conditions. So slowly, the conditions are getting better.
You know, you write in the book that this helped you understand the ruthlessness of Asian capitalism. What do you mean?
I think capitalism in a lot of countries was terribly ruthless. And you think about Dickensian capitalism in Britain or what went on in 19th century America. But in some ways, I think one can make the case that Asian capitalism has been particularly so. At least the kids in 19th century Britain got Sundays off. Traditionally, in a lot of countries in Asia, they did not get any day off at all. And in fact, Harold and I talked to young people working in factories in Guangdong, and they would go for months and months of 12-hour days without a single day off. And likewise, it's not just the working conditions in a sense, but we thought that often the sweatshop activists, for example, missed the worst aspect of sweatshops, which wasn't the labor conditions, but which was the environmental impact and the people that they killed in the area around because of the effluent that they produced. And so, I mean, we think that the industrialization of Asia is a tremendous thing for Asia, but that it also has some pretty awful consequences, and that it's a balance that is worth making and is overall positive. But I don't want to deny at all that it's a very, very grim and ruthless process.
Your book is a mix of very specific stories that you reported on, individuals who you met, sweatshops you saw. But you also include in the book a lot of larger thoughts about the political, economic, and social situations in Asian countries. And you write that you think Asia is likely to wrench economic, diplomatic, and military power from the West over the coming decades. In what way do you think that they'll be doing that?
Over the last few hundred years, power, the center of the world, if you want to call it that, moved from the Mediterranean countries on up to England. And then about 100 years ago, the U.S. took it from England. And now we think that this process of industrialization is coming to Asia. And in particular, it's beginning with economic growth, that soon most of the world's economic output will be coming, most of the world's GDP will be coming from Asia. And that countries are pumping their money into military budgets. They're developing, well, better sports teams, as we saw in the Olympics. In almost every aspect of human endeavor, you see Asia becoming more important. And we think that that reflects a sense in which the center of the world is shifting. Gradually, two steps forward, one step backward toward Asia.
You also say that in many ways, Asia today resembles Europe a century ago when rising incomes and education and urbanization spurred nationalism and antagonisms that provoked two world wars. What are the similarities you see?
The oldest problem in international relations is how you accommodate a rising power. And that was the central problem that 19th century Europe had, how to fit in a richer and more powerful Germany into the concert of nations. And they did not succeed, and the result was World War I and then World War II. And now Asia has to figure out a way of letting China and later on India find some way of accommodating their greater sense of power, their aspirations for a place at the table, without upsetting the order and international security that has been established in the area. And I think there is some risk that Asia's future will look a little like Europe's past.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu-Dunn collaborated on the new book, Thunder from the East, based on their reporting from Asia for The New York Times.